I'll probably try to go fast on some slides that you might have seen already and slow on others, but just let me know. But because it's a small audience, please feel free to ask questions. So you all know about gravitational waves, so I'm not going to give you the usual tutorial. They are, gravitational waves produce a strain, a quadrupolar strain in the spacetime. They are predicted by the linearization of Einstein's equations. So if you solve Einstein's equations in vacuum as a small perturbation of Minkowski, you get gravitational waves predicted. And the problem with those, you can also get a formula for how the strain, that perturbation of Minkowski, will relate to the sources, and they relate to the acceleration of the quadrupolar moment of the sources. So you need a quadrupole moment, a mass quadrupole moment, and you need it accelerated. That's why a binary system is the best example, because a binary system has a quadrupole moment that's very easy to calculate, and it has a nice acceleration to calculate. It's just omega squared. The problem with that is that there's a very small constant in front, Newton's constant, and a very large speed in the bottom to the fourth power. So then the amplitude is very small. The only one nice thing about this formula is that it's inversely proportional to the distance and not to the distance squared. And that's because it is a field and not power. We are not measuring power. We are not measuring energy.
Why do you think this is nicer, or do you think this is nicer for gravity waves than it is for electromagnetic?
No, no, not at all. I mean, the nice thing about electric fields is that a dipole can produce electric fields. Here we need a quadrupole, sure. So there's no dipoles because...
But they both decay as one over R.
The field in both cases decays as one over R, yes. But in most... With telescopes, in light, yes. With regular telescopes, you measure power. By the light that you measure on your CCD, it's not the electric field, it's a power.
But I don't know. It's hard. I mean, like, if you have a radio telescope, you see, if you measure the electric field on you, and because that's what moves, causes a current in your radio telescope.
Yes. So different instruments measure are able to measure different quantities. The best way to do it is to measure fields, because then they only decay as one over the distance. But for most cases in at least electromagnetic, the visible spectrum, you measure power. In this case, we haven't measured either one yet. But in principle, what we are talking about this deformation in distances, that is a field effect. Mm-hmm. When you talk about how that translates into a measurement, you can imagine ways to measure it in power or in field. But what the measurements with interferometers are measuring the field, because they're measuring the transformation, the linear distances, the linear changes in distances. So when you put a nice quadrupole in there, like a binary system, and you put it at some distance, like the Virgo cluster distance, and you put the quadrupole in there, and you put the distances, you get very, very small numbers. You get 10 to the minus 21, and that's for a dimensionless strain for frequencies in the hundreds to a kilohertz or so. So that's 10 to the minus 21. That's a strain. That's a difference in distance to the distance, to the radius of the circle. So, of course, the larger the circle, and you can think about planetary systems, you can think about galactic systems as the distances you are talking about, even then, the changes in distance that you are trying to measure are very, very small. Of course, if you're thinking about the ground, then the distances in here are either meter scale for lab experiments or kilometer scale for the interferometers we are talking about. So that doesn't discourage people or funding agencies. So there is a worldwide network of ground-based detectors that is currently operating. Actually, it was operating until last week. There are still some detectors operating and some being upgraded. There are two observatories in the U.S., in Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana. In Hanford, Washington, both of these are 4-kilometer observatories, L-shaped. In Hanford, there are two detectors in the same vacuum system. These are all in vacuum. In Virgo, there's a 3-kilometer detector. All these, the one of the detectors in Hanford, one in Livingston, and the Virgo detector were operating for the last year and a half. The Virgo detector is still operating. A couple of years ago, we had all 4 detectors operating together for 2 years for the LIGO detectors. There's a GEO detector in Germany that is operating and will be operating for several years. That's a 600-meter-long detector. There is just approved last year funding for a cryogenic underground detector in Japan. So the field is still growing and getting wider. That will be a 3-kilometer detector in the Kamioka mine. And there is a site in Australia, in Jinjin, near Perth, on which there might be, and this is looking more likely by the month, there might be one of the LIGO detectors might actually move to Australia. So that would make a nice worldwide network.
What's the deal with the cryogenic?
I'm not going to talk much about the sources of noise, but I'll show you the sensitivity we have. And in some of the frequencies, we are limited by the Brownian motion of the test masses that we use. So Brownian motion, temperature, cryogenic helps. So that's a basic idea. Now, for the LIGO and GEO, the LIGO and GEO detectors are part of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, which is the collaboration that collaborates for developing the technologies, but also for doing the data analysis. And this slide is never up to date, but I just updated it because we have the PI on CETA there. So.
How about well?
No. I didn't put Guelph. I forget what the letter says. I think it was Chan. Yes. Yes, I think the letter said PI.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But it is nice because there are institutions really all over the world. I mean, Australia, China, Korea, all of Europe, many different places in the U.S., but there was none in Canada until last month. I'm not going to put PETA in that.
That was my personal favorite. But you're not on the LIGO Scientific Collaboration?
No, I'm indirectly through sending whatever things they may be able to use from what I do, but I'm not in the LIGO.
Not direct, I see.
Yes, there are many people who do astrophysics and we collaborate with, or perturbation theory in numerical relativity or in general relativity, and we do collaborate a lot, numerical relativity, but they're not necessarily members of the collaboration. The members of the collaboration are in principle the ones who have an interest in looking at the data. And to look at the data, you cannot do it from outside the collaboration. If you want to look at the data, you have to be a member of the collaboration, which is not difficult and it doesn't take. But we'll see what Chad says in a few years.
Couldn't the members show us the data, or is it the data?
I'm sorry?
Could the members show us the data?
No.
No, they
cannot. Not officially.
No, in fact, we consult each other on what results we can show and how we can show them. And yes. So you're not seeing the latest, the very, very latest. You're seeing the very latest that can be shown. So I only showed you pictures of the detectors. This is actually the sensitivity of the LIGO detectors in what we call the S5 run. That was the fifth time we took data and analyzed the data. That's why it was called S5. It was the year in which we achieved the gold sensitivity. The solid line was our gold sensitivity, and this is an amplitude spectral density in strain versus hertz. This is strain per root hertz, but think about that as the strain in one hertz band.
Is
this one actually displacement?
Actually, this one is displacement, yes. I like, being an experimentalist, I like displacement a lot better. And I thought it was a lot more appropriate to show here, because if you look at the, this is the precision we have in each frequency beam for measuring the difference between those 4 kilometers and these 4 kilometers in each of the three LIGO detectors. So we had H1, which is the LHO 4 kilometer detector, L1, which is the Livingston 4 kilometer detector. We had the 2 kilometer detector in Hanford, which will become 4 kilometers in advanced LIGO, or might become the Australian detector. And all of those three achieved the gold sensitivity in most of the frequencies we were interested in. You can see them departing here, but here the sensitivity is so bad above the best that you don't care so much. So low is good here. This is noise. This is the spectral density of the noise. So if you're going to see a gravitational wave, it has to produce an effect that's much larger than the noise. The larger the gravitational wave, the better. The lower the noise, the better. And this is 10 to the minus 18 meters. This is 10 to the minus 19 meters. And I know that theories sometimes don't use units, but you might...
Sorry.
But you might remember, or you should remember, as good physicists, that 10 to the minus 15 is the radius of the proton. So we are measuring very subnuclear distances over 4 kilometer length. And you can trust the calibration. I've worked in calibration. It's not pinned down better than 10%, but within 10%, this is true. This is real. We were having this sensitivity beginning in 2005, and we took data with this sensitivity for 2 years.
So which branch of the sensitivity curve is thermal noise?
Yes, I should mention that. We do know more or less what the limiting sources of noise are. Most of this is short noise. It's a quantum noise in the light. Most of this is seismic noise or the effect of seismic noise in our suspensions. And this is always been kind of a mystery noise. We don't have a precise explanation of what's in here. We've been able to make it better with a lot of work, but on technical sources. But our prediction for Brownian motion is just here. So even if we got rid of whatever this mystery noise is, we wouldn't go much below this. In fact, we think that this may be thermal noise due to some extra lossy materials we had. What are the peaks? That's the most common question I get. We have lots and lots of peaks. Most of them, yes, they're not pulsars. Most of these are 60 hertz power lines, which are, of course, at 50 hertz in the European detector. So this is 60 hertz. This is 120, 180, and so on. These big peaks are the thermal noise, the Brownian motion of the wires that we use to suspend our test masses. So you could hear them. They're 400 hertz, 345 hertz. So you can, if you put this on a speaker and filter that, you can hear a very nice tone.
So the Japanese proposal to a cryogenic is to remove this spikes or to
access no, it's to lower this limit posed by the Brownian motion. Yes.
But it's a narrow region of the spectrum. It's a lot of effort for a narrow region.
No, because they're also underground, so that helps with the seismic noise. Mm-hmm. And of course, the short noise you can always improve using more powerful lasers.
This is quite interesting.
So this is actually the most difficult part. We call this the bucket because it's the lowest region, but it's the most difficult to achieve, especially to model, to explain. So we took data for 2 years with this sensitivity. We analyzed the data looking for many different signals. We have different working groups looking for sine waves produced by pulsars or rotating stars, looking for a stochastic background, looking at the correlation between the detectors, looking for bursts without any model for those, produced maybe by supernova explosions, cosmic string kinks, your favorite model that produces any burst. We ruled it out because we didn't see anything. But the one I'm going to talk most about is this search for the gravitational waves produced by binary systems. Not only because we have a nice formula for that, which means that we have a nice model, so we can use this matched filtering technique to look in the signal for a frequency dependence that we know, so that we can look deeper. We don't need that signal to stand out above the noise. We can look for it in the noise. So how far we can see with that? So this is 10 to the minus 19 meters. Remember these, the binary neutron star systems would coalesce at about a kilohertz, but we would see them best in this frequency range because that's where we have the best sensitivity. So given this spectrum, how far we can see these systems? Well, we can see them about to the Virgo cluster in average. If the system is actually best aligned, if the stars are aligned, for a binary neutron star system, we assume 1.4 solar masses. Yes. So if we assume black holes, if we assume larger masses, we can see much farther away. But we don't know how many of those there are, so we we kind of limit our predictions, not our search. We do search for lots of different mass ranges, but for saying what we expect and for plotting our sensitivity, we use binary neutron stars.
How many neutron star binaries you have?
Because we know three binary pulsars in our galaxy plus one in the Magellanic Cloud, so that's four.
But those are pulsars, not neutron stars.
Those are binary pulsars with neutron star companions. So these are binary neutron star systems that point the radio beams to us. Mm-hmm. So they would coalesce in less than a Hubble time. So from that, we extrapolate to how many there are in the galaxy that are not pointing the radio beams towards us. And then from that, we extrapolate by how many there are in other galaxies, depending on how luminous they are. And that's how we see. So actually, that's how we predict the rate that we are going to see. The distance to which we are going to see it, we don't need that because we do know the amplitude of the signals given the distance. So if you give me the distance and the orientation of the system, I know what the amplitude is going to be, so I know whether it's going to show up in here or not. So this 15 megaparsec distance that we have, which is about the distance to the Virgo cluster, is for an average orientation in an average location on the sky. And for that, we expect about one coalescence every 50 years, which, of course, for the 2 years we took data, is not very promising. So we have looked in the S5 data for binary neutron star, for low-mass systems, and we have not found anything yet. This is showing that we don't always measure 15 megaparsecs. In fact, we only got maxima of 15 megaparsecs in the last few months of the run. This is the median range to binary neutron star systems in each day of the run. So we took the data for 2 years. There are 700 days in here. And you can see that we had good and bad days. The goal for the run was 10 megaparsecs. So we started the run when the 4-kilometer detectors had the goal. But we were able to improve the sensitivity and keep it there. I mean, it was going up and down, but we kept it there for quite a while. So this was proof, especially to the funding agencies in the US, that we could reach a sensitivity that was promised and that we could keep the detectors running for a significant amount of time. And then the next thing we had to prove is that we could analyze data. Of course, they would be happiest if we found something, but I didn't put the legend. It's a different, the three LIGO detectors. Green is the Livingston 4-kilometer detector, red is the Hanford 4-kilometer detector, and blue is the Hanford 2-kilometer detector. And this is where you see how, if you remember before I showed you the sensitivity, and it's about the same for all three detectors in distance. But when you translate that into strain, this is where size really matters. Because if you have a detector with the same length sensitivity but half the distance, you can only reach half as far. So this was a two-year run, and I wanted to tell you about the results we got and how we got those for the for the search for low-mass systems, but including binary neutron stars. And I didn't mean to put an animation here, but so we are looking for binary neutron stars. We know what the template is for different masses. So we have a template of masses. We actually made a template bank that had total masses between 2 and 35 solar masses. But then we also did another search, a high mass search, that went up to a total mass of 100 solar masses. We limited our minimum component mass to one solar mass. It takes too long, as Chad knows, for his thesis to look for smaller systems. So we are looking for this template in this noise. Different mass systems have not just different amplitudes. Higher mass systems have much higher amplitudes but much shorter waveforms. Here we are starting the waveform at the frequency where we can start seeing it in the band of our detector, which is about 40, 50 hertz. So you want, for high mass systems, you can see much farther, but only for a short time. For binary neutron star systems, you don't see them as high, but you see them for a long time, and that's why we win in that case. So we match filter the data, which means that we make a correlation of the template with the strain, and I hope that with the data that we have from the detector, and I hope that Chad showed you the nice animations that he made on how this works. The idea is that if you have something hiding in the data and you are using the right template, then when you put the template at the wrong time, you just see some random noise. You always see something. It's not zero, but you just see some random noise. And then at the time where your template matches your signal, you see a peak. And this is called the signal-to-noise ratio. So we are going to quantify our candidates by the signal-to-noise ratio in the data of each detector. But we are going to use coincidence. We are only going to believe it if we see it in more than one detector. And we need to apply data quality, which has been a painful process in the last several years, discovering that the data is not very stable, but it's also very dirty. We have to clean it up a lot. We can never clean it really well. So we need to use four known waveforms. We can use some other tests like signal consistency that what we found, when we find a peak like this, we go back to the data and then we see that each piece of the data looks like the template we are finding. And that's called a chi-squared parameter that Chad, again, had a lot to do with. And from that, we calculate. We don't decide yes or no on whether we saw something. We just calculate how likely is it to see a peak like this just from noise, and we call that the false alarm rate. So the data analysis that looked trivial to do to us experimentalists before we began taking data is actually not trivial at all. Yes?
So I understand how you can discretize the parameter space of the sources in terms of masses, because if you change a little bit the mass of waveform, it's not so different. So you have a way of discretizing.
Right.
It's not so different. What is less obvious, I think, is how you discretize time. What sets your step? You have to probably discuss. You must have
yes,
discretize
yes.
in time. So
yes,
what sets your amount by which you shift your templates in time for the coincidence? Is it set by an orbital period of the binary? Or the
No. It's much smaller than that. We do it. Chad, you might remind me. We do it for a few samples of our sampling rate, but we downsample data. So
the sampling rate of the instrument.
Yeah. Right.
The big thing is that you. Expecting efficient waves at a kilohertz using Nyquist frequency will be, you need to have double that frequency basically for your sampling times for a minimum to be able to recover information.
And that's what you do?
That's what
you yes.
So there's a zillion, times.
Yeah. But you don't keep all of this data. You only keep these peaks, the time of these peaks. That's
so
why it
you
looks.
You have to try it for each template, and there's many.
For each template, yes.
Yes.
That's why it's so computationally intensive. But then, for each template, you don't. in principle, for each template, you have one time series. In practice, the only thing that we store for each template
right.
is the times for which that template crossed some threshold. And we call those triggers. And it is those triggers that we look in coincidence between the different detectors. And then, of course, we have to interpret the results, whether they're positive or negative. So these are some plots from Chad's thesis on how this chi-squared parameter really works. Actually, this is one of the great advances from... It's funny how many theoretical papers that were about how to search for signals before we began taking data, and how different they all look, how funny they all look now that we have real data. So whenever you look at real data, it turns out that many times you have glitches, something that in this diagram, this is a frequency time diagram I'm showing. It's something that has some structure, and it would be very interesting if it was the same structure in two detectors. And it but in general, it's not. However, you cannot rule out the gravitational wave, because a gravitational wave might be very well aligned with one detector and not with the other, so you cannot rule it out unless you know what it should look like. So this is what the chirp signal, what the binary system should look like, and this does not look like that. So it doesn't look like that to the eye, so how do you quantify that? Well, you quantify that by breaking your template in little pieces and making sure that you have the power that you expect in every piece, and that's called the chi-squared parameter. So here we have a scatter plot. This is a bit difficult to explain, so I'm going to go fast, but if you want, I'd come back. It's a scatter plot of triggers, of the chi-squared of the triggers versus the SNR of the triggers. And this blue shows what we expect. So we don't always expect a very low chi-squared, which is what you would expect for a good signal. But sometimes if the SNR gets very high, the chi-squared also gets very large, because you are missing it by just a little bit, but the signal is so strong that just a little bit becomes a big number too. So this is what you expect for signal. This is actually measured, simulated, but measured injections that we had in the instrument. And this is what our triggers look like when we look for coincidences, not in real time, but the way we estimate our background is doing the data analysis in this detector, doing the data analysis in this detector, and instead of looking for signals that are coincident at the same time, we fake the time in one detector. We add 10 seconds to the GPS, and we look for coincidences. Any coincidence we find, we know it's not real, because gravitational wave doesn't take 10 seconds to go from one detector to the other. You know, it can only take 10 milliseconds. So any coincidence, we know it's a false coincidence. It's a background trigger. And that's what these red triggers look like. So we can distinguish those in this plane. And that's what we use to produce what we call an effective SNR, which is kind of dividing the SNR by this chi-square. So if you have a very strong glitch, it has a lot of power, so it will have a very large SNR, but it will also have a very bad chi-square, so the effective SNR will be a lot lower. They are based on real data, but they are software injections. This is what we expect signals to look like. We inject in the data simulated waveforms.
Well, that's not real data.
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
No, we. I wish we had found this.
But the red one, that's also based on the simulations, or the
those are not simulations. Those are coincidences, actual coincidences, but found when we fake the time in one detector.
So that's based on real data.
That's based on real data without any added waveforms. Yes.
The blue, though, just to be clear, the blue, the software injections do involve real data.
Yes.
It's just an addition of additional signal.
So you add something
on
top of real data.
Yes, on top of the data, yes.
Which is critical, because that's actually what causes you to see a lot of those blue outlines. That if you just had Gaussian noise, you wouldn't see that sprinkle of blue stuff that's caused by jump.
Yes, all those things. But of course, we don't expect, when I told you that we had a range of 15 megaparsecs, so we could see up to the vertical cluster, I was thinking about an SNR of 8 in one detector. It's an R of 8 is here. So we are looking at the corner of this plot in here. We're looking for, we could be lucky and find very large signals, but we're most likely to find small signals. So in the very beginning, in the analysis of the first and second sign, and even the fourth science run, we were using just plain SNR. We were looking for coincidences. So this is a scatter plot of the SNR in one detector versus the other. So these are coincident triggers. Again, coincident triggers with a fake time. So this is our background. When we put our real triggers in here, we want to see them stand out of this, but they get very large tails. And the green dots in here are the ones that we simulate. They are the blue ones in there. So this is what things look like before we use chi-squared. When we use this effective SNR, then all these tails shrink because they all have a very bad chi-squared. So this is our background. Now the same simulations we had that were mixing in with our background in here get separated in here. So we have a much better chance of looking at, again, an SNR of 8, and 8 would be here. So it would be clearly separated from our background. And this SNR of 8 was chosen long before we knew anything about real data. People thought SNR of 8 was going to be so rare that it was a good number to choose. Here, when we began doing this thing, SNR of 8 is here, right in the middle of our background. No way we could see something there. So, yes.
The difference between effective SNR and SNR?
Effective SNR is essentially our SNR scaled by the chi-square, divided by the chi-square. There's a more complicated formula with a couple of parameters that we tune, but yes, it's reduced by the chi-square. So if the chi-square is what you expect from a template, then it would be about the same. But if the chi-square is much worse than what you expect for the template, then it would be much lower. So an SNR of 100 might be reduced to an SNR of a few because the chi-square is really, really bad. So this is still in, we are looking at coincidences in here for the scatter plot, but here this is still using a single detector. And now you have to combine things, and now you want to know how, what is the false alarm expectation. And here we had the problem first with our lowest sensitivity detector in S5, where we had H2 that was half as sensitive as the 4-kilometer detectors. And then when we analyzed with data, we always imagined that we would be using data from detectors that were all similar. It turns out that no two detectors are similar, and sometimes one is very different. So you don't want to throw away anything that's not triple coincidence. You want triple coincidence, but if it's not triple coincidence because the low sensitivity detector didn't pick it up, you don't want to throw it away. So you do look at double coincidences like H1, L1, which were the sensitive detectors in S5, and you also look at triple coincidences. Now, you do find many, many fewer triple coincidences than double coincidences, even when you do this faking in time, because it's more difficult to have triples and doubles. So if you have an even, this is effective SNR already. So if you have an effective SNR 8 and 8 in a double coincidence, it's not the same as having the effective SNR coincidence at 8 and 8 in a triple coincidence. So the false alarm rate is what measures the strength of the signal. It's not the SNR, not even the effective SNR. It's the likelihood that you would find it in the background accidentally. And that is different for doubles and triples. And it sounds simple now, but it took us a while. So it was only S5, and I think the second year of S5, when we really combined these results using this false alarm rate. So finally, all this was to explain the plots that you see in our analysis of S5. So this, we have three papers now in S5, and realize I didn't put the references here. I have them in the next, well, there is a reference here. This one is 2010. We have three papers on the first year, the first half of the second year, and the second half of the second year, because that was data that we analyzed jointly with Virgo. So that third paper that has this plot is jointly, it has, I think, something like 600 authors, because it has the LIGO collaboration and the Virgo collaboration in there. Even though probably the work done for this one paper, of course, there are many, many other papers, but for this one paper was probably done by about 20 people.
Is 600 collaborating like a record, or is like LHC this
large? LHC is bigger, but I don't know that they all signed the paper together. I'm sure that the Higgs paper, I'm sure the Higgs paper would be signed for more by more authors. More than the Higgs? I don't know. Maybe that's it. Maybe there's a bet there. Anyway, so what we have settled down as a way to show results is the coincidences we have found. So these blue triangles are our candidates versus not strength, but versus the inverse of the false alarm rate. And it's the inverse because you want to see them with a large number. You want a large number to be a good thing. And a large number means that you would accidentally see it every many years. That's what a large number means. And here we can plot the background that we expect and the one sigma background that we expect. This is from our measurements. So one is the lowest number we can measure for coincidences. And this is the loudest event that we have. And the loudest event we have is what we expected from the background. That's what this plot is showing. This is what we found in S6, in which the loudest event we found was almost unexpectedly low, a low number. But we decided that there was nothing wrong. It was just unlucky. In fact, you might be able to see in here, but we do have 100 different trials, and this is among the lowest number you can get from the trials, but it's not, it's at a few percent likelihood. So, but what you really want is something down here. You want one event at a very large inverse false alarm rate, and we didn't get that.
What would that look like? I'm trying to imagine, so you expect a certain number of coincidences, and...
Well, for the first time, we expect one, but...
is what does the signal, so there really is a black hole binary that's going to merge now. What characteristics does the signal need to have so that it stands out on this plot?
It needs to have a large SNR and a good chi-squared and a coincidence in at least two detectors, but... If it is large enough, then you would see it in more than two detectors.
And what goes into calculating the chi-square? So I understand the signal to noise, but what is the chi-square?
It's how well the data matches the template, but not integrated over the whole duration of the template, but on each piece at a time. So you break the template into different pieces, all with the same power, and now you decide whether the power in each piece is what you expected.
Okay.
So that's what chi-square is.
And then if I have all of those things, then I'll wind up with a dot that's far from the yellow kind of expected error.
That's right. So you first need the highest SNR in coincidence, then you need a good chi-square, so it goes down, and of course you need a low background. You need, and the background is what you measure when you do these fake coincidences, so that it stands out above the background. If your data is very glitchy, then your background is going to be high. And even if you have a good SNR and a good chi-squared, it won't stand out. So we didn't have any detection in S5. I'll tell you quickly about the latest run in S6. Yes?
I have a question. So those points were not supposed to be correlated, were they?
They are, because it is a cumulative histogram.
They look very correlated.
They're very correlated.
Because it's cumulative. That's
yes.
Fine. Yeah, good.
And I have to say, I hate cumulative histograms, but I've always lost that battle.
Okay.
I don't win every battle. So we didn't have any detections, so we can calculate, we can interpret our results, not as a detection, but as an upper limit on the rate of coalescences. And that depends on the mass of the systems that we study. So we plot that as an exclusion diagram with rate on the vertical axis. And in this case, total mass of a binary system. And in this case, the black hole mass of a neutron star black hole system. And the thing to notice from here, well, the units that we use are rate of coalescences per year per L10, where L10 is about half a Milky Way. A Milky Way, L10 is 10 to the 10 blue solar luminosities, and the Milky Way has about 1.2. So this is per year, and we have numbers of 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, but for high masses, for binary neutron stars, we are down here, we have 10 to the minus 2 or so. If you look at what we expect, what are the rates that we expect from these few systems that we know, and extrapolating from those systems to black hole systems, we actually just put a paper together with what we think it's out there, and we've been criticized on both sides for these, some of these numbers being too high or too low. But a realistic rate for neutron star binary systems is about 100 per Milky Way per million years. So that's 10 to the minus 4 in these units. And we are at 10 to the minus 2. So we are not contradicting this number at all, not even this number. And same is true for black holes. So our results do not yet have an impact on limits that we have, unless you can always invent crazy theories or crazy rates, but we are not yet putting, we are calculating, and that's what we needed to do. We can analyze the data, we can interpret the data, and we can set up numbers, final numbers, interpretation from the data. But we are still not doing astrophysics. At least not with this. We are doing something I'm not going to talk about. I'm just going to shift gears now. But we have done what I think are the most important astrophysical observations, which are coincidences, looking for coincidences with gamma ray burst observations and with some of these hyperflare, hypermagnetars, and things like that. So in those cases, we can rule out some of these strong gamma ray bursts of being binary systems that are very close. We cannot rule out binary systems that are far, but we can rule out binary systems in some radius. So we are doing some astrophysics in that respect. But what we have done here is proved that we can achieve a good sensitivity, we can take data, and we can analyze data. That's a lesson, at least from my experimental point of view. It took 10 years, but we have done that. So now I wanted to show you pictures. So this is a complete change of gears. This experiment sounds boring and difficult when you look at the analysis and the results, especially if there are no detections, but it is actually a very fun experiment, at least for an experimentalist to work on. We do have an interferometer. It's essentially a Michelson interferometer. It's in a vacuum system. We have suspended masses hanging from thin wires. Those are the ones that produce that Brownian motion that you were showing, that you were asking about in the pics. Those systems are in vacuum on top of seismic isolation systems that are essentially masses and springs. That is all inside vacuum chambers. We have an optical topology that's not just a simple interferometer. It actually has Fabry-Perot cavities in the arms. It has a power recycling cavity to increase the power and decrease the short noise. We have sensitive photodiodes outside vacuum, handmade. This is Nergis Mavalvala and Ray Wise. Nergis just won the MacArthur Fellowship, for those who don't know or know her, which is a very prestigious fellowship. She's now a faculty at MIT. Nergis Mavalvala. And she does quantum optics. Squeezed experiments using squeezed light for gravitational wave interferometers. And this is our control room. This is our data. So you see it's not zero, but we know it's noise. At least we know that there's nothing standing out. That was even before S5.
Is that purple thing the mass?
Yes, it is the test mass, it is a mirror, but because we use infrared light, this is a mirror in the infrared, so it looks reddish. It looks pretty, I think. That was initial LIGO, though. That was the instrument that we used to take the S5 data. That finished in 2007, almost 3 years ago. Since then, we were doing the data analysis. The advanced LIGO funding had just been approved. It was approved in 2008. But we did have some things that had been developed and were ready to go, and we wanted to try them before we had everything together to initiate advanced LIGO. So we call that enhanced LIGO. And this tried, from my point of view, it was a way to try advanced LIGO technologies, especially a new way to read out the signal that made it easier to increase the power. If you increase the power, you get better shot noise, but increasing the power was proving very difficult because we were saturating these photodiodes with what we call junk light. So if we wanted to increase the power, we had to increase a lot the number of photodiodes, which was terribly complicated, so we thought we would try something else. We've diagnosed some of the noise as coming from magnets, so we changed that. We wanted to try some active seismic isolation, and we wanted to try for this new detection scheme. It needed another optical resonant cavity, a crystal optical resonant cavity in vacuum, and we needed in vacuum photodiodes. So that took about a year to set up, and it was done. And here's the comparison between H1 and L1 in the S5 run, the spectra I showed you before, and H1 and L1 in this new run. And you can see the effect of going from 6 to 30 watts from increasing the power. You get better at the quantum noise level. And we didn't get quite better in here, but we got better in here. And these frequencies do matter a lot for looking at binary neutron star systems. So the range that we got, so we had 14, 15 megaparsecs for these best spectra. Sometimes people call these typical spectra, but they're actually our best spectra. For S5, for S6, we had 19 and 20 megaparsecs. So we did get 5 megaparsecs, even though these frequencies do not matter very much for these binary systems. It's the bucket what matters. But even then, we made these things work. And this run ended a week ago, in October 20th. So on October 20th, there were several people waiting right outside the lab just to get in there and begin disassembling things and getting things out of vacuum, because the advanced LIGO hardware is ready to go. And that's what I wanted to show you. What is happening where?
Yeah, the low frequency and
here, yes, sorry. This run was also in coincidence with Virgo, at least most of the time. In fact, Virgo is still running for another year or so. And we had these figures of merit, we call them, printed in the electronic log every few hours. And these were the H1 and L1 spectrum. This was the Virgo spectrum. And the Virgo spectrum is much better at low frequencies than us. It has half the range. This is the range in Virgo, so this is what I was saying. We always have one detector that's down there. Hopefully that will not be the case in the future. But so this was H1, L1, and Virgo. So Virgo doesn't have a good range because it doesn't have a good spectrum in here, but it has a much better seismic isolation system. It has these, we call them the PISA towers. They have these huge suspension towers. We have a single suspension for our systems. They have seven-stage suspension system, yes. And that's what produces that. So I wanted to rush through some pictures of advanced LIGO to show you that everything is ready to go. I mean, not quite. It will take several years. But we are using the same vacuum system, the same facilities. So the vacuum chambers themselves are going to be the same, which was a pain. These are very expensive, so it was... there wasn't enough money to get new ones, but now you have to fit everything in that space. So you want to make everything bigger, but it still has to fit in that space. So we are reusing all of that. The optical topology, I told you it was not just a simple Michelson for initial LIGO. It had these arm cavities. It has this power recycling cavity. It has this input mode cleaner. All that was what we used in S5. For advanced LIGO, we're going to have the same mode cleaner. We're going to have a better, for reasons that are difficult to explain, but a better power recycling cavity. We're going to have the same arm cavities. We're going to have a signal recycling cavity. So this is going to send a signal back and forth to amplify the power. And we're going to have this output mode cleaner in the readout. This we have already. This we tried in S6, and it worked. This signal recycling was tested. It has been used in the Geo600 detector for a long while now. Yes? No, not much. I mean, it is going to change, but not much. The power is going to change a lot, though, because we are going to use a lot higher power, and the finesse is about the same. So the suspensions, these are our initial LIGO suspensions. It was just this nice mirror hanging in a single thread, and that was fitted inside this vacuum chamber. Now we are going to have quadruple suspensions, and you only see two here because there are these two masses, and then there are two springs, blade springs, that are the two upper stages in here. But these are quadruple suspensions, and in fact, it's that times two because there are reaction masses in the back that we use to push on these. The mirrors are better too, so that improves the thermal noise and the Brownian motion that we have and the optical quality. We don't have metal wires, piano wires anymore. We have glass, fused quartz fibers that are monolithically fused to the mirrors, and that all improves the seismic, the Brownian motion. And these are actual pictures. These are actual pictures of prototypes in being tested at MIT of the mirrors that are already polished. So things are there. It's not just plans for the future. The laser was a 10 watts laser that we used in initial LIGO. It's going to be a 200 watts laser from Germany, from Centrum, associated with the University of Hanover. And it's already, they have all the parts. They have one laser already, I think already on the way to the Livingston Observatory. So, and we have been testing in S6 a 30 watts piece of this laser. For S6. So we have tested half the system already. For the seismic isolation, for those people who know, this is a student who just graduated from the LSU group, and that says, congratulations, seismic isolation team. And that is a cake I think his girlfriend brought for celebrating the installation of this big seismic isolation system on the small chamber that was again being tested in S6. So this is something that we have tested already. So in initial LIGO, we had these masses and springs supporting these tables in the small chambers. Sorry. We had in the big chambers, we had these masses and springs supporting a table from which the suspension was hanging. In advanced LIGO, we're going to have this platform sitting on this active isolation platform, and that's what was tested in S6. So that works. It works to specs. In fact, it works so well that they increase the specs. So now they can do it better. It is all active, measuring and pushing. It has blade springs and seismometers in vacuum. And for the big chambers, there is this squared. So there is this on top of that, plus some hydraulic actuators outside the chambers. And those hydraulic actuators have been tested at Livingston for the last several years because they were needed there due to the increased seismic noise in Livingston. So this is the expected spectrum for advanced LIGO, and now we believe that we will get here, because we have gotten to this initial spectrum, even though it was predicted 10 years before it was achieved. So we think we are going to get this or very close to this.
Where are you now?
We are now
sorry,
in this we are here.
That's the same thing.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. This initial LIGO was the sensitivity we achieved in S5. In S6, we got a bit better on this, about the factor of 2 better, factor of 4 if you look for the right frequency beam. But this is a factor of 10 better. So we still have a ways to go. But now we don't have anything because everything has been taken apart. Actually, that's not quite true. Everything is being taken apart in L1. Everything had been taken apart already in H2. H1 is going to stay like that for a while because we are going to do an experiment using squeezed light, using the squeezed states for the coherent states of the laser, so that we can see whether we can improve the sensitivity, the quantum noise, even though we don't increase the power of the laser. And that would allow for an easier trade-off if it works for advanced LIGO. If increasing the using 200 watts gets to be too difficult, we'll just squeeze the light. So that is going to be an experiment going on in H1 in the next year. In L1, we are now, well, people are cleaning out the vacuum chambers, and then there's going to be pre-stabilized laser, input optics, corner interferometer, full interferometer. The schedule puts us with the first interferometer at about mid-2013. Of course, it's going to take probably a year or two until we get something working. So I think the idea is to probably have a science run in 2015. The promise to the funding agency has been 1 hour of coincident log in 2014. That was a very precise promise. So the range we're going to get is 10 times larger. It's about 200 megaparsec for that curve I showed you. For the extrapolation that we had before, the same one that said that we would have a coalescence, an observation with initial LIGO once per 50 years, says that we are going to see about 40 systems per year for binary neutron stars. Of course, that's with 200 megaparsecs, but with 100 megaparsecs, we would still have a few per year. So even in the earlier science runs, when we are not quite there yet, I think we can be very optimistic. And of course, that is for binary neutron systems. You can also look at or add to those neutron star black hole systems or black hole systems. And you can also be more pessimistic. You might say, well, maybe that's too optimistic. This is actually what we call a realistic number. This is what we call a low number. But if you're a pessimist, you might be here. But even if you're there, with a few years of data, we should be seeing things. Those are the ones that we expect. They are calculated assuming a signal-to-noise ratio of 8 in each detector. We don't assume a false alarm rate. The false alarm rate will be given by the detector. And, of course, there is a lot of work that goes into making an SNR of 8 significant. But we only calculate this number. We can only calculate this number assuming a signal-to-noise ratio. So this is 8 in each detector, just like the 15 megaparsecs that we had. Yes, although we... Yes, because in principle, all three detectors would be 4 kilometers long, so we expect them to have the same sensitivity. And of course, one of those might be in Australia, although that might take a bit longer. So I claim that we are going to be seeing a lot more of the universe. We are going to be seeing things in time. If we don't get them in the first year, we only have to wait a few years. We are going to be, if not seeing black holes, which I'm sure we will, but even if we're not seeing black holes, we will know that black holes of certain masses are not there. And that is already very important. But the observations of gravitational waves from neutron stars are there, so those are coming to you soon. So that's it.
So you have this depiction of the local neighborhood of the universe. And do you know if people who make these predictions for the rates, the account for knowledge that we have on the specific galaxy in the library, or they tend to do things that are just some average star formation rate?
Well, you can ask Chad, who did a lot of that in the very beginning, at least.
Yeah,
that.
It
all gets
the
what?
Galaxy forms at some rate, but then Andromeda might be slightly different, and then if you go to this elliptic galaxy, it's very different. So
right.
All of that is accounted for, given the structure of the local neighborhood?
Not so much. No. For the most part, we just use blue light, so we assume constants on star formation. If you do want to correct it for like just kind of doing a little to put in a model, you might get a factor of 2 or 3 different, but it's not going to change. So, but then secondly, the error bars, the numbers guy we just showed you. So, just assuming some uniform density nearby is fine.
But it also gets very smoothed out because it's not that you need to get to 16 megaparsecs to see Virgo. If the signal is well aligned, then your range is 20 megaparsecs. So a well aligned signal, a well aligned system in Virgo will appear with a signal to noise ratio much larger than 8. So if the stars are aligned, you can get larger systems. So the distance at which you begin to see, be sensitive to systems, it's not the discrete distance that the galaxy is, it's smoothed out. So I think all these inhomogeneities kind of get smoothed out. It is the star formation rate what matters a lot more. It's not the discrete position of the galaxies.
Well, it's the history of the star formation rate.
That's right.
So,
yes.
So I'm not. It's interesting, and maybe it's only a factor of 2 or 3, but I wonder if there is more there.
Yeah, it could be, and I think some of the models that went into that paper. So
for double neutron star, if you have a burst, you might have to wait a giga year. It's an integral of the star formation. That might be this kind of formation that I can use.
Yes.
That's a good point. The rates that she showed then are probable and are realistic and pessimistic numbers. Actually, basically, there's all other research where some of the things were answered. People have done this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you have to take those numbers with a grain of salt, but that was also the idea of showing the range of the numbers. And there is a lot of work going on population synthesis with different kinds of models, and they try to fit the likelihood for the different models, but I don't follow that very much.
Well, it's a dirty business.
It is, but so is ours.
What is the duration of the signal that would be seen if there was a neutron star?
Well, that's a nice thing. In this spectrum,
mm-hmm.
See, if you have a threshold of about here, then you only begin seeing it when it crosses this frequency.
Right.
But at the same level here, you see it when it crosses a much lower frequency. So the signal is a lot longer in your band, and that gives you a lot more reach. So
what is the actual time?
So in advanced LIGO, I think we expect minutes. Few to many minutes, depending on the masses of the system. In here, I think the longest templates that we use are tens of seconds. That's 40 seconds. There is a paper, and that also shows you how naive some people were. There is a paper about, I think it was using this sensitivity that was called the last 3 minutes.
So presumably, the first detection will be a strong signal well above the numbers. Because if you have 40 per year, you have 1 or 2 per year that are well above your sensitivity. So you should turn advanced LIGO, and after a year, you should have a strong.
Well, if you turn it on,
data analysis, it's just, it should be there.
If you turn it on at 200 megaparsecs, what I think is most likely to happen is that we will have a detector that has a range of, I don't know, 50 megaparsecs, and then we'll take a few weeks of data. And then
right.
We have a detector that has 150 megaparsecs. And
but in essence, it should be pretty obvious, quickly, or there is a problem with the predictions.
Yes,
no,
but the predictions have such a wide range that.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I call a problem with the predictions.
Yes. They already have a problem.
They can go from 4
yes.
to 0.4. So.
But the point is that at that sensitivity, you are constraining these models. at the sensitivity we have now.
As an astronomer who knows a little bit the dirty business and goes into this population settings, but not being involved with them, so I can be skeptical free, I worry that you build a $1 billion machine or whatever, and then that's, it's a worry. And I think it's a worst case scenario, but if it turned out that way, it's...
Do these short memory bursts get sort of a sanity check in some sense? So it's pretty cool.
Well, I think
I'm leaning on the skeptical side here. You don't want to be. People have looked at AI.
Yes, I think the gamma ray burst limit is down here. Yeah, but I think if you assume, you have to assume some beaming angle, and that in itself is a dirty business. But a limit from the gamma ray limit, it's not very large. It's below this number. So it doesn't give you much. On the other hand, coincidence with gamma rays increases the confidence a lot. It decreases the false alarm rate. So an SNR, you don't need an SNR of 8. You might make a detection with an SNR of 5. So, yeah. That's why we are practicing already on how to make multi-messenger astronomy and make joint observations. And in fact, we are doing in S6, the last few months of S6, we had an alarm system in which we send alarms. I mean, we have always been receiving gamma ray burst alarms ourselves and making sure the machine keeps running. But now we have sent alarms with things that were coincident. We knew that they were almost likely to be false alarms, but we did send them out to telescopes, so that to SWIFT and SAROT and several other telescopes. So they would move around. So we do have some things. Of course, it would be great if they result in detections. We have not gathered all the data yet. But even if it doesn't, it's an experiment that shows that we'd be able to do it with advanced LIGO. So it's all happening.
Okay, so Gabby will be here till Sunday, so she'll be around. And since tomorrow I'm teaching, she'll be alone for most of the morning. So more than welcome to her entertainment. Okay, thanks.
And I can tell you more about all the dirty business on our end. Thank you.
Me? Just.